This episode of On the Media is supported by Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of On the Media, NPR, and other shows while on the go without downloading or syncing with Stitcher Smart Radio. Thousands of popular podcasts and programs are available on demand. Stitcher instantly delivers new episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone without syncing or downloading. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or at stitcher.com/media.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. For the past few months, American media have done what they rarely do: focus on events beyond our shores. Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, Japan. But this week, our national attention returned to battles over budget-cutting, birthers, and Donald Trump. The appetite for overseas stories appears to have dried up. Mark Jerkowitz at the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism says that a few weeks back, Libya and Japan made up more than 40% of the news, an extraordinary number. But now, even as fresh horrors rain down on the people of Libya and Japan, the American media look elsewhere for leads. Perhaps, says Jerkowitz, that's because events out there have become both more complicated and less new. A lethal combination for coverage.
In a strange way, there's kind of a new normal with both of those crises. There was this real explosion of Libyan coverage. But after a while, it became apparent that this is now a grinding civil war that wasn't going to be resolved, as I think some of the news media thought, as soon as the NATO planes started bombing. It's almost gruesome to say it settled into a plateau when civilians are being indiscriminately shelled and there's so much bloodshed. And the same thing with Japan. It, too, is kind of settled into this kind of ongoing tide of bad news, but not necessarily dramatic or shocking news that's going to continue to command the news media's attention, particularly at a time of dwindling resources.
Many civilians have been endangered in Libya and journalists endangered. Obviously, journalists ought not to be singled out. They tend to be by the media. Do you think that may change the coverage?
We should say that first and foremost, there's been a dramatic reduction of coverage in Libya in the last few weeks anyway. But I do think that if more and more journalists find themselves in very unsafe conditions with no one to turn to, then I think that could further lead to a reduction of coverage just for safety and security reasons. Although this is a story that right now is very much on the wane, not to say it won't be recharged by events such as a significant military victory or defeat on one side or the other, or certainly Gaddafi leaving the country. But right now it feels like we're in it for the long haul and that there's definitely diminishing U.S. media interest in the story.
The American public is different from the rest of the world when it comes to its engagement or lack of engagement with foreign news, isn't it?
There's been a suggestion, obviously, that the American public doesn't pay that much attention to events overseas unless they directly involve American interest or American troops. If so, that might be a case of the chicken and the egg. I mean, there's not a lot of media coverage of these kinds of things around the world. I mean, one of the things that we found that's fascinating is, of all the United States military commitments now, the most active one, perhaps the one with the highest stakes, is the war in Afghanistan. Yet, you know, we almost call it the forgotten war here at the Project for Excellence in Journalism. With troops on the ground, with casualty counts growing every year, it has failed to sustain major, significant media coverage. It never, for example, achieved the level of attention or coverage that the media gave, for example, to the war in Iraq.
Mark, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Brooke.
Mark Jerkowitz is the Associate Director of the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism. Steve Cole covered his fair share of natural disaster and war in his decades as foreign correspondent at the Washington Post, and he found that there is a template for many stories, no matter how harrowing. In his experience, earthquake and disaster coverage in general follow a 12-day editorial cycle. He witnessed it while covering an earthquake that killed tens of thousands of people in Iran. The first few days are spent reporting breaking news and casualties and destruction. Around day five, the late miracle story in which search teams find an improbable survivor amidst the rubble. Day seven brings the interpretation of meaning story with religious overtones. By day 12, it's essentially Bye-bye for now.
Most correspondents run out of laundry, or patients or their editors feel that the story is no longer getting on A1 and so would be better to invest in another subject. And the best way to create a sort of placeholding story was to write that, you know, to be sure, the recovery will take a long time and there will be many challenges ahead. So it's a sort of forecasting story that also says we're not going to be here tomorrow.
Still, Cole says when he looks especially at the coverage of the Japanese nuclear crisis, he's puzzled by the way it's calmed down.
There's still a lot of unanswered questions about exactly how much radiation is being emitted and whether the approaches that the government is taking are plausible or likely to succeed. I do think the changes in our national media economy make a difference. 20 or 30 years ago, the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Miami Herald, the Baltimore Sun, and the Philadelphia Inquirer would all have had correspondents swarming into Japan. There would be wire service and syndicated reporting coursing through the systems, and the broadcast networks would be responding to the persistence of that coverage. In the current environment, if the Times isn't covering it, if NPR isn't covering it, it may not really exist.
Should we be worried about that?
Well, we are a global power with military and diplomatic interests and deployments all over the world, and we expend tax dollars and put lives at risk all the time in complicated foreign environments. So, yeah, it's a problem. We ought to be thinking about these places on an empirical basis in greater depth than we sometimes do.
You don't have to get snotty about it.
I wasn't trying to be snotty. I was just frustrated.
Have you got any guesses on which is the chicken and which the egg? Are the media reflecting a waning public interest, or have editors' interests waned and moved on to domestic affairs, the budget battle, Donald Trump, etc., and so readers, listeners, viewers have largely moved on too?
I think there's a follow the money aspect of it. It used to be believed by a lot of the publishers and editors that the money they invested in international coverage was a kind of public service, something they could afford to do with their surplus profits, that it was not an imperative of what their audiences wanted. We used to do surveys, at least at the Washington Post, and when you ask people, what did you get from your newspaper yesterday that you couldn't get anywhere else that you really valued? They provided two answers again and again. One was very local news, and the other was international news. I do think there are substantial numbers of Americans who want strong, good coverage of international affairs, but it's so expensive to cover these kinds of crises properly in a professional way that if you're struggling to even break even over the course of a year, it's very easy to send your correspondents home early or to not go to some prolonged crisis like Libya's with just a bleeding checkbook at all.
Steve, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Journalist Steve Cole is the president of the New America Foundation. Anthony Shadid works for one of those news outlets for whom Cole said Libya still exists, the New York Times.
You know, we don't leave the story just because, you know, people aren't interested in the story. And I think a lot of journalists will feel it is almost a mission to cover these stories when no one cares about them.
Since the Libyan uprising, some 49 journalists have been detained, some brutalized while in custody. There have been 11 physical assaults and 4 journalists have been killed. 2 of those journalists died this week, photographers Tim Hetherington and Chris Hondros. Anthony Shadid was among several journalists detained last month for 6 days by Gaddafi forces before being released, abused, but alive. I wondered, what did he want us, his readers, to know when he was in captivity?
Well, I think when we were taken, our biggest concern was that we'd be forgotten. You know, in our case, and I think every case is different, it's hard to say that there's any rule out there. You know, we were 4 people in it. Conflict is raging around you that involves millions. We were obviously very lucky and treated much better than we probably could have been. But I think selfishly, when you're in that situation, you do hope that you're not going to be forgotten.
Did you know the 2 photographers who were killed this week?
I did. Both those men were incredibly brave, who took it upon themselves to chronicle a story that a lot of journalists wouldn't want to cover because of the danger.
A number of journalists who have been killed have been photojournalists, I guess because they need to get even closer to the action.
I hate to speak for photographers, but, you know, just my sense as a writer working with them is that, you know, the image is their work. Chronicling those images and those stories in a very visceral way is the task before them. And it's, without question, it is the most dangerous task.
New York Times reporter Anthony Shadid is based in Beirut. Lindsay Addario is a photojournalist who was kidnapped along with Shadid by Gaddafi forces last month. She's photographed conflict for over 15 years, but despite her history of documenting the most dangerous places, she says she's never covered a place more dangerous than Libya.
I've covered Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, Congo, Darfur, a number of conflicts, but the way the front line is laid out, there's one road that goes through the desert, and it's a wide open road and very flat. So as Gaddafi's troops were fighting the rebels and coming in from the west, they were shelling with tank fire, mortars, airstrikes, and PK machine gun fire, all of that without a place to hide for cover. So basically, if you were 500 meters away from the front line, you couldn't cover anything because all of the fighting was going on in this place that was wide open.
The two photographers that were killed this week were killed by mortar fire. Did you know them?
Yes, I did know them. I knew them well. You know, we've all seen each other in the field for years, and Tim Hetherington and I, when he was filming Restrepo, I was out there for about 2 months on and off. Tim was an incredibly sensitive person, a very intelligent person. He was kind. He was empathetic with his subjects. I mean, he was just a really amazing photographer, as was Chris. Chris Hondros and Tim Hetherington produced some of the most enduring images of conflict of our day.
Reporters don't want to be presented as some kind of exception to a tragic rule of civilian deaths. On the other hand,
a loss is a loss, whether it's a journalist or a civilian. I just think it reverberates in our circles because these are our friends. And, you know, we all know the price that any of us can pay doing this job. And it's difficult to come to terms with that.
Lindsay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Take care.
Photojournalist Lindsay Addario.
This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation, working to grow economies and expand human welfare. Learn more at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Over the past few years, we've spent a lot of time examining present and future business models to monetize the newspaper industry.
Present and future business models to monetize the newspaper industry.
We've discussed display advertising, classifieds, online ads, paywalls, even donations. But here's one we hadn't thought of. Litigation. In the past year, a company called Righthaven has filed more than 250 lawsuits against blogs and websites that have reproduced some or all of a piece of newspaper content, article, photo, illustration, whatever, without permission. Here's how it works. Newspaper publishers like Stevens Media, owner of the Las Vegas Review-Journal, or Media News, owner of the Denver Post, agree to work with Righthaven. They sell some copyrights on their articles to Righthaven, which then trawls the web looking for people who have posted all or part of copyrighted content online. Righthaven then sues those people, usually for $150,000, plus it often demands the infringing party give the entire site over to Righthaven. No warning letter, no takedown request, just a lawsuit. Reporter Joe Mullen of paidcontent.org has been closely following Righthaven. He says that many Tom, Dick, and Harry defendants, lacking the resources to fight in court, quickly settle for thousands of dollars.
So they've sued over 250 people. They sued the Drudge Report. That was a big name. But their more common lawsuit is really against a mom-and-pop blogger or a website. So during campaign season, for example, they sued political websites. They sued the website of Sharon Angle. They sued the Nevada Democratic Party. They have sued hobby bloggers. They sued a cat lady who was blogging about cats from the perspective of the cats.
They're not necessarily wishing to go to court and have jury trials over the rights to this material. They give bloggers or whoever an opportunity to settle from the get-go.
Yes, they do give the opportunity to settle, and they've reached, I believe, over 100 settlements. We don't know much about those settlements because they are, like nearly all settlements in civil litigation, confidential. But there have been a few that were reported, and they were in the sort of $5,000 and under range.
Righthaven is not a law firm that is representing its client, Stevens Media. It has actually acquired the intellectual property, all of the material that appears, for example, in the Las Vegas Review-Journal, the articles, the photos, and the illustrations. It says it's the owner and therefore is suing not on Stevens' behalf, but on its own behalf, right?
Yeah, so that's a similar model to what's been going on for just about a decade now with what are sometimes derogatorily called patent trolls. And those are small companies set up on paper, often owned and operated by lawyers, who acquire patents solely for the purpose of threatening litigation and filing litigation. So what they do is take a piece of intellectual property and try to turn it into a pure moneymaker.
At least one small website felt that it was being shaken down and it's fighting back. Tell me about the Democratic Underground.
The Democratic Underground is a liberal political blog. And what's going on now is they are pursuing a counterclaim for attorney's fees against Righthaven, and they insist that Stevens Media should be involved in that counterclaim as well. They also, on Friday, finally were able to unseal the document that describes the deal between Righthaven and Stevens Media.
At that point, the world found out that the ownership of the content in question was itself in question. Tell me about that.
So there's a lot of important rights that come with copyright, such as the right to make new copies, the right to distribute, the right to make public performances. Righthaven had been saying it had a lot of those important rights, including the right to distribute. But now it turns out that the contract looks like Righthaven really had only the right to sue. Now that we know what the contract looks like, there are a lot of people asking whether the transfer of copyright that Righthaven did is even valid.
Now, there's no law that says that lawyers can't be entrepreneurial. Tort lawyers have rounded up classes for class actions, you know, for a long, long time and made a lot of money for themselves and for their clients. Is there anything about the Righthaven case that suggests that they're in any way on the wrong side of the law?
There's nothing wrong with Righthaven going around getting newspaper industry clients, selling themselves by saying, we can help deal with illegitimate copying online, and we can help you get paid for that through the courts. It's perfectly legal to do that. Now that we've seen the Righthaven contract, there are some lawyers who are looking for examples where Righthaven may have lied to the court, seeing if Righthaven said that it had certain parts of copyrights that it didn't actually have, that could get them in trouble. And now what I have a couple sources saying is there are very likely to be defense lawyers, including possibly defense lawyers who worked with clients who already settled, wondering if they have some kind of counterclaim to be made.
Okay, Joe. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Joe Mullen is a reporter for paidcontent.org. Righthaven says it is merely protecting ownership rights from content thieves and acting properly under the law. Still, it has suffered some publicity hits from Mullen and others. When Righthaven sued a chronically ill, mildly autistic blogger named Brian Hill, it found itself at pains to withdraw the suit on what it called humanitarian grounds. Steve Gibson is the CEO of Righthaven. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
You've set up your business to sue many, many people. Very few of them have the wherewithal to take you on in court, and therefore some have felt obliged to simply settle for no small sum of money. Some of them feel that they are being squeezed.
First of all, this business is addressing copyright infringement and theft. Your characterization that this business was established to go after the little guy in a mean-spirited manner is just plain wrong. Does Wrighthaven know when it sues a particular party what their net worth is? No. I think the question that is legitimate is, to the extent that, you know, we take the profit motive out of it, does Wrighthaven serve a purpose of advancing the protection of copyright interests of content owners? I think it does. And is there a balance that's being struck by the fair use discussion? Absolutely.
Let's talk about fair use. There was a case in which a nonprofit was sued by Wrighthaven over printing in its entirety content from the Las Vegas Review-Journal. The judge found that because this nonprofit was neither in the market area of the Las Vegas Review-Journal nor in any way in competition with the Review-Journal, that this was a fair use and could be done without penalty. I'm wondering if, as a result of these lawsuits, you could actually end up expanding the definition of fair use to actually permit exactly the kinds of infringement that you're trying to litigate.
I don't think that Judge Mahan in that case, by any stretch of the imagination, indicated anything but a fair use analysis being a case-by-case examination. But to answer more directly your question, if we end up expanding the scope of fair use and defining with more clarity the parameters of what is permitted and is not permitted, we have no problem with that.
It was my understanding that Wrighthaven actually purchased the copyrights from its partners in this enterprise, Stevens Media, for example, owner of the Las Vegas Review-Journal, and that therefore you're not suing to protect a client's rights, but in fact you are suing to protect your own rights. But a document unsealed in one of the cases suggests that, no, you actually aren't the owners of the copyrights, only for the purpose of securing damages in court. Can you clarify that for me, please?
Sure. The first is, I think that that agreement is being grossly misinterpreted by the press, and people running with things like sham and fraud, frankly, ought to be ashamed of themselves in that kind of inflammatory language. If you read the agreement and you read the assignment is very clear that Wrighthaven acquires the entire title and copyright interest in and to the copyright work. And the fact that in the course of acquiring that, there is a license back for use purposes to the original assignor, there's no law out there that suggests that that negates the original assignment.
In the linked internet culture, clearly, while there is a cost to having your content appear somewhere else, there's also a benefit if it drives people back to your website. Is it possible that Stevens Media and others who have assigned copyright to you would have been better off by doing nothing?
An organization like Stevens Media or even the New York Times should have the ability to control the dissemination of its content and control the monetization of that content. If your content can be posted anywhere by anybody and searched, and the momandpop.com site, if searched appropriately, is the first place that it's read, that inevitably is going to negatively impact the economics associated with being the exclusive provider of that information.
Knowing what you know now, would you ever advise a media organization that approaches Wrighthaven to think very carefully before it starts filing lawsuits against all comers?
I feel more firmly today than ever that the protection of copyrighted works is important, and that the means through which Wrighthaven is able to achieve that will be demonstrated as certainly beneficial to content providers. I just don't think that retrenchment right now into a policy of sending takedown letters is going to be successful. And as the economy continues to be an information-based economy and a digital-based economy, the value of people's activities are going to be tied to content production, and that needs to be protected.
All right, Steve. Thank you very much.
Take care.
Steve Gibson is the CEO of Wrighthaven. We'll be right back.
Earlier this month, a user on the website Metafilter started a thread critiquing an op-ed written by Scott Adams, the cartoonist famous for creating Dilbert. As other site regulars piled on, one newly registered user mounted a strident defense of Adams. The new user, whose name was Planned Chaos, conceded that while he also, quote, hated Adams for his success, he'd be remiss if he didn't remind everyone that Scott Adams was a multimillionaire, that Scott Adams possessed a certified genius IQ, and that Scott Adams' detractors were angry haters. Metafilter's moderators are able to see the identities of users who access their site, and so they knew that Plant Chaos was, in fact, Scott Adams. One of those moderators, Josh Millard, asked Adams to either leave the site or reveal his identity. Millard says that even if he hadn't known it was Adams, the tone of his comments might have given him away.
It was certainly conspicuous. But yeah, it had that stink of this is a very strong investment this random drive-by person has.
Right. In fact, it was so obvious that after this Planned Chaos posted his defense of Adams, someone else wrote, "Welcome to Metafilter, Scott Adams."
Yeah, fundamentally, there's nothing wrong with being anonymous online. You know, lots of people have legitimate reasons for wanting to not associate their public identity with some of the things they do or say. But the problem that arises is we generally expect people to be honest about when they're a stakeholder in what they're discussing. And you can even do that anonymously still. You can say, "Hi, I work in this field. Here are some of my observations," as long as you're at least forthright about where you're coming from, if not what your actual name is. But when the topic is you, there's not really a way to do that fairly. I mean, you can't transparently go around pretending to be a disinterested third party just so you can high-five yourself by proxy. You know, it's pretty unquestionably deceptive, and people don't like being lied to.
And is it obvious why people do it, so that they can manipulate people in that way?
I think people don't think it through. You know, when it first occurs to someone that they can do this, they're probably going to be thinking about this partly because they're feeling defensive already. And if they haven't considered the consequences, they may just see it as a consequence-free to sort of get some personal justice. Of course, if the consequences actually do exist, it becomes something that blows up in their face usually, and that's not really what they were hoping for.
Well, Scott Adams interviewed himself on his website recently. He had his Metafilter alias Planned Chaos interview him on precisely these questions, and he justified his behavior by saying, quote, "Some time ago, I learned the hard way that posting messages with my own identity turns any discussion into an orgy of name-calling. When I'm personally involved, people speculate that I'm being defensive or backpedaling or being a douche nozzle or trying to weasel my way out of something." He also went on to say that there's no sheriff on the internet. It's like the Wild West. And so for the past 10 years, he's handled things in the masked vigilante style whenever a rumor needs managing.
As far as there being no sheriff on the internet, I think that's a very reductive view of the internet. The internet is a heterogeneous place. You know, it depends on where you are. And I feel like what happened here is Scott Adams decided to go to a place that he decided he knew what the rules were. And then it turned out that wasn't it because he hadn't paid attention to the community norms he was interacting with.
You know, a lot of the sock puppeting examples that make the news tend to involve people who already have power or visibility. For instance, John McKay, the CEO of Whole Foods, got a lot of flack for sock puppeting. And various authors have either been caught writing their own self-laudatory reviews, like the art critic Lee Siegel, or arguing against their critics under assumed names. A couple of months ago, Sarah Palin created a second Facebook account with a fake persona who praised the other Sarah Palin on Facebook. Doesn't it seem strange that people who already have their own soapboxes resort to this?
I think it absolutely is strange, and I think that's why these stories tend to get attention. I mean, obviously, the sock puppetry is a jerk move. If you're a famous person, it's a jerk move. If you're a random nobody. And if you're the owner of a local grocery store and you're talking yourself up online, it might make the city newspaper. But if you're the CEO of Whole Foods, more people know what Whole Foods is. More people are going to react to it being weird. I think the other part of it is there's this emotional issue involved where when people see someone who already has those significant resources to work with, it seems a lot more petty when they're doing it, because like, why would you choose to do this? You know, you have already the ability to defend yourself. You have a much louder megaphone, a much bigger platform than almost everybody reacting to already. It seems so out of scale. It seems like stealing candy from a baby.
Well, then let's talk about an instance revealed last month where the stakes are considerably higher. A story that the U.S. military was developing software to manipulate social media using fake online personas. These sock puppets would allow the U.S. military to create a false consensus, crowd out unwanted opinions. This is straight ahead propaganda.
It's again, it's one of those things, it's the same sort of reasoning where if you think, hey, well, no one will notice, we'll get away with this, then hey, all you look at is the upside. But yeah, as soon as it becomes clear that that's been happening, you sacrifice a bunch of credibility. And when that's happening at the level of a national military, that's obviously a lot more problematic than one person's reputation taking a hit, because at that point, it's sort of representative of the United States. Every United States citizen has a reason to think, wow, this is a serious ethical misstep being done in my name, essentially.
Maybe it would help if the United States interviewed itself online, the way that Scott Adams did.
I would pay to see that.
Josh, thank you very much.
Thanks again for having me.
Josh Millard is a moderator at metafilter.com.
And now a letter from a listener. Garth Barfield of suburban Washington, D.C. writes, I love the show, but I have one complaint. Why isn't there more Bob Garfield? His voice is somehow both dulcet and virile. His questions are sharper than a razor fashioned out of lightsabers. His eyes are like blazing infernos of scalding righteous truth. His breath like a zephyr of apple blossoms.
This is On the Media.
His cannonball deltoids like
on
cannonballs.
On the Media.
His smile.
On the Media.
Good letter.
This episode of On the Media is supported by Stitcher Smart Radio, offering the Stitcher mobile app. With Stitcher's free app for mobile phones, listeners can get the latest episodes of On the Media, NPR, and thousands of other podcasts on demand without downloading or syncing. The free Stitcher Smart Radio mobile app can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or at stitcher.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, Brooke reported from Cairo on the Egyptian media post-revolution. This week, we return to the early days surrounding the ousting of Hosni Mubarak with a new book called Tweets from Tahrir, a collection of tweets sent from the epicenter of the revolution. Now, a book composed entirely of months-old 140-character or fewer dispatches may sound, frankly, kind of pointless. But the book actually tells a compelling and unique story of the popular uprising that rid Egypt of a three-decade-long dictatorship in just 18 days. The tweeters featured in the book had no idea they'd be successful, and yet throughout it seems as though their resolve for change builds upon itself. Nadia Idle is one of the book's editors. She grew up in Egypt and now lives in London. She says that when the revolution began, she watched Al Jazeera for the pictures, but she was getting her news from Twitter. Her goal for the book was to capture a very specific moment in Egyptian history.
We've got 55 tweeters who are part of the book, and a few of them are sort of the main characters that we follow all the way through for different reasons. Some of them are very emotive and were sort of very expressive in the way that they describe things. Others were very technical and providing very specific information about what's going on, and some were incredibly funny. And what we wanted to do was really capture a picture, an image, a snapshot of our experience on Twitter.
Give me an example of funny, and while you're at it, maybe one of poignant or especially shocking.
I'll give you a funny one I've got in the beginning, and this is really a comment on Tunisia. Musab El-Shami writes, Dear people watching Arabs Got Talent, there's a better show going on called Tunisia's Got Freedom. Watch that. There's also funny, but also poignant in a sense. Egyptocracy says, I told my mother I will be on the street on Friday, and she didn't try to stop me as usual. And then there's the tweet on the 4th of February by Muhammad Yahya saying, No one can imagine the beautiful feeling one gets as you enter Tahrir Square. It's like coming home and being surrounded by loved ones. There's also some really sort of dark moments. On the 3rd of February, Mona Shosh reported that two of my friends confirm another one is shot through the head, dead. My friend called me crying. This is awful. Something has to be done. So that gives you, I hope, an idea of all sort of the different sorts of tweets that we had. And as the drama changes, slows down and speeds up, you also read the book at that pace as well.
Revolution in 140 characters or fewer.
Absolutely.
Now, I still have to ask you this because there's something nagging about the whole idea of printing tweets on paper, which to me is like something along the lines of taking songs off your iPod and then burning them onto a CD or maybe even pressing them into a vinyl record. It's retro technological. It seems like it's, I don't know, going backwards and forwards at the same time.
The thing is, each individual tweet is not only of individual significance, it's of a historical significance. So what this exercise is to document history. If you now try and go back to the time of the revolution and try and use hashtag Jan 25, it's a very, very difficult thing to try and load all the old tweets. It's not the same as taking a piece of music and moving it from one format to the other, because when you listen to it, now you might say the quality might not be the same on one format as it is on the other, but in fact, in this situation, that story is lost in effect.
Did you include any feeds from Mubarak loyalists?
No, we didn't, for a simple reason. Frankly, they weren't on Twitter very much. And also, we wanted to make a book about the people who changed the world and not the people who were against it, in a sense. But it is a fact that that there were very, very few anti-revolutionary voices on Twitter.
You've mentioned more than once that you believe that this book tells the story of these remarkable 18 days that shook Egypt. What is the story in the end? Was there one tweet that you think particularly distills it into 140 characters or less?
There are so many good tweets, but I think there's one that stands out, and it's the one that goes, "I'm scratched, I'm beaten, my face is covered in blood, but this is the best day of my life." And I think that distills how so many people felt. They felt they had one chance to throw everything at the possibility that they would be able to be part of the future of their country, that they would be able to be part of the building of a democracy with some kind of equality for the 80 million people who lived in that country, that was it, and that it was worth throwing everything at, despite the violence, despite the insecurity, and despite not knowing what the outcome would be.
Nadia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nadia Idle is an editor, along with Alex Nuns, of Tweets from Tahrir, out now from OR, that's O-R, Books. In other printing out the internet news, we turn to James Bridle. Bridle is a publisher, blogger, and all-around techie. Last year, he chose one entry on Wikipedia, an entry being the Iraq War, and he printed it out. But not just the page you see when you look up the Iraq War on Wikipedia today. He used Wikipedia's history function to print every single edit made to the Iraq War article on Wikipedia between December 2004 and November 2009. Every single edit over the course of 5 years. Why on earth would anyone want to do that? The answer for Bridle has something to do with documenting how history is written and with the fleeting nature of information online. Turns out, to print out history, you need a lot of paper. Bridle says Wikipedia's Iraq War article resulted in a series of printed books the size of an average analog encyclopedia.
12 large hardback books, small type, 3 columns per page, 7,000 pages. That collection actually embodies the complete history of that article, every change it's gone through, not just the finished version you'll see when you go to the site now.
So that's what it is. What it isn't, I guess, is intended to be beach reading. In fact, you're not publishing this for mass distribution at all, are you?
No, I quite like to think of it actually as a bad visualization, as in a visualization that isn't immediately obvious how you should use it. What it does show you is the sheer weight of information, of argument, and of people's time that goes into constructing what appears to be a single medium-sized article on the Wikipedia as it stands at present.
Okay, so I have this fantasy of a radio program called What the Fill in the Blank is The Matter with You with Bob Garfield. And if you were my first guest, and you might be, my question for you would be, what the is the matter with you?
My answer, Bob, would probably start by saying that I'm a bibliophile. It's a deep and abiding love for books that borders on the obsessive and also makes me see books around me and everything that there is and try and make books out of them.
But this is beyond a love of books. This is about watching kind of in real time how history coalesces. Can you give me an example of a change or a sequence of changes to the Iraq War article that is a vivid demonstration of the importance of seeing the whole evolution of a Wikipedia entry?
There's two main examples, and the first one is vandalism, where someone has gone in and simply erased the entire article and written, "Goddamn Saddam Hussein," or "Screw you, Iraq," or "Screw you, US," and that's reverted and changed back to the previous version within seconds. The other one is the arguments over casualty figures. There was a particular period during 2004, 2005, when there were a number of competing standards, essentially, for how the war and its casualty rates were judged. The US general in charge famously said, "We don't do body counts." As a result, there's a number of organizations. There's one called Iraq Body Count. There was another famous study done by The Lancet, a British medical journal, trying to work out some kind of authoritative body count for both combatants and civilians in the war. And you can see over through 2004, early 2005, if you look through the change in the Wikipedia article, you'll see these different figures being used with different prominences. There's a huge amount of political fighting going on over which figures should be used by Wikipedia as the authoritative figures.
There's something paradoxical about the internet, and especially, I guess, history on the internet. On the one hand, everything that shows up there is there in perpetuity. Anybody who has ever been slandered online knows that it's essentially impossible to expunge. On the other hand, everything has this maddeningly transitory nature because it's there for a moment, and at least in Wikipedia, then it's gone. To your mind, which aspect of the internet more informs how we perceive history and everything else?
I think that understanding of the internet as something that means it's there forever is a huge and quite dangerous fallacy. My case example for this was GeoCities. GeoCities was the first make-your-own-homepage site on the web. By the end of the last decade, it had millions of users, millions and millions of web pages on it. It was many people's first experience of the internet. And then 2 years ago, Yahoo deleted it. Now, a portion of it was saved. A couple of organizations went in there and archived as much as it could. But actually, a huge part of popular culture, something that really shaped the internet as we know it now, was quite simply deleted and wiped away. And that actually is happening all the time on the internet. It's incredibly important that we start to address these issues as the internet matures, that we need to think very carefully about what of it we should be archiving and how much of it we should be saving.
James, thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much. Good to talk to you.
James Bridle is a publisher based in England. He writes about the nexus of the internet and history at book2.org.
On Tuesday, the CIA declassified the government's six oldest classified documents dating from 1917 and 1918. According to the CIA's news release, quote, "These documents, which describe secret writing techniques and are housed at the National Archives, are believed to be the only remaining classified documents from the World War I era." Now, this raises a couple of questions, at least. Why does the U.S. government still have classified documents from World War I and secret writing techniques? Here to answer those questions and maybe tell us how to open a sealed letter without tearing the envelope is Spencer Ackerman, senior reporter from Wired.com's national security blog, Danger Room. Spencer, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So when you read that first news release, were you surprised?
Stunned would probably be a better way of describing it.
These particular documents describe espionage techniques used by the Office of Naval Intelligence during the First World War, including recipes for making invisible ink.
Yes, this was state-of-the-art technology for your World War I era spycraft. It's a series of recipes for how you would concoct ink that you couldn't read without doing some kind of treatment to the paper or to the ink itself, how to open a letter without its intended recipient knowing, or in other cases, how to tell if there are secret messages that the untreated eye would not be able to detect.
Some of these documents are really quaint. Like one of them suggests that a solution of sodium nitrate and starch in water could be carried, for example, in handkerchiefs or starched collars.
It's important to remember here that this is an artifact of the time before the United States really had a robust intelligence apparatus. For the past 60 years, we've had multiple and multiplying intelligence agencies whose budgets total up to $80 billion annually. But back in World War I, there was pretty much postal inspectors, the Office of Naval Intelligence, the FBI, which isn't involved in these techniques, was barely 15 years old. It's a weird thing to encounter in this day and age that these documents would really look like state-of-the-art spycraft for, you know, precisely the reasons you're mentioning. We're seeing recipes for, you know, a few cc's of sulfuric acid, sugar, and heat as a way of keeping secrets.
There was an assistant chemist at the Department of Commerce named A.M. Heinzelman, who had concocted several recipes for invisible ink, and he noted that one of them could, he said, quote, exert a very corrosive action on steel pens, and therefore, if suitable in other respects, it would be better to use a quill.
Yes, so we're not even talking about state-of-the-art penmanship and inking techniques from 1917 and 1918. We're going really, really far back. I mean, what's so amazing about these documents is how far into the future they've been stamped as requiring to remain secret. The document that you just read has an annotation from March 15th, 1976, saying that it has to be regraded secret, and then that's crossed out and over which is written confidential. So that's got to still remain secret, even after all of these techniques have been vastly overtaken by advances in secrecy.
Why? You can go online or to the back of a comic book and get more effective invisible ink.
Well, this becomes the subject of a lawsuit 10 years ago between some declassification advocates and the CIA. And that's where we get probably our only real explanation for why they have to remain secret. And that comes from a court filing in March of 1999 from a woman named Teresa Wilcox, who is the information review officer at the Directorate of Science and Technology for the CIA, in response to a lawsuit filed by an individual named Mark Zaid. What Ms. Wilcox said to the court was that the unauthorized disclosure of the intelligence methods specified in these documents could jeopardize the security of the CIA's more modern systems of covert communication because they were, in fact, quote, in part derived from the formulas in these documents. She goes on to suggest at a different point that these methods are, quote, currently viable for use by CIA agents. So, you know, which would you have it? Either they're the historical antecedents of some concealment techniques still in use, or theoretically, they're being used now. That's been the rationale of record until suddenly CIA Director Panetta decided to disclose them this week.
And in that official news release I mentioned, Panetta was quoted as saying, "These documents remained classified for nearly a century until recent advancements in technology made it possible to release them." So what are those advancements?
They don't exist. It's not the most credible position taken by Director Panetta. The CIA denies this, but the lawsuit I just mentioned has been going on for quite a while. And recently, Zaid and one of his colleagues filed an interbureaucratic filing requesting a mandated disclosure. That happened in 2009, and that got appealed to something called the Interagency Security Classification Appeals Panel, which is just meant to make sure that the government doesn't needlessly overclassify information. And Zaid and his colleagues believe that a decision to mandate disclosure of this information was imminent, and the CIA got out ahead of it.
Do you think that these secrets now revealed mean we're less safe?
No. It's impossible to credit that suggestion. I think that a terrorist learning about how to spray some ink with lemon juice and heat an envelope in order to reveal a hidden message is probably not going to result in any gigantic national security disaster.
What is the CIA's best method for opening a sealed envelope?
You know, if I disclose that, they'll kill me.
Spencer, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Spencer Ackerman is senior reporter for Wired.com's national security blog, Danger Room.
The invisible ink will reveal that everyone should meet at the warehouse immediately. Do not ask me where I got the invisible ink. Urine. It was urine.
That's Dwight Schrute, pencil pusher and would-be spy master from The Office on NBC.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, and Sarah Abdurrahman. And it was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson, and she had help this week from Rob Granis.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Garth Barfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.